Is there a difference between a purpose and a call? Yeah, I do think there is, but I'm struggling to, you know, get real smart suddenly. The Bible seems to be very consistent all the way through both Testaments with this visitation that seems to come from heaven that separates a person out to a unique activity. I would suppose that the description of the activity that responds to the call is more or less what purpose could be. You have some wonderful purpose statements in the Bible. Ezra 7:10, and Ezra devoted himself to the study of the law, its observance, and the teaching of it in Israel. That would be Ezra's purpose. And by the way, that key Hebrew word devoted is a wonderful, wonderful word in the Older Testament. It carries over into the New Testament, into the New Testament languages. But it has this, it first appears in Genesis 2 where it says, a man shall cleave to his wife. The literal there is, he shall be devoted to his wife. We have this human capacity to give ourselves to an idea, a thought, a person, and that's the word devoted. It's the Hebrew word hesed. Then you get Ezra devoting himself to this purpose, which is threefold, studying the law, doing it, and teaching it. In the New Testament, you have Paul in Colossians. I think this would be his purpose statement. Christ we preach, warning every man and teaching every man that we might present every man mature in Christ. Jesus in Luke chapter 19, verse 10, the Son of Man has come to seek and save lost people. That's his purpose. No one understands his purpose at that point. They're miffed that he goes to the house of Zacchaeus. And he, in effect, says, you don't understand my purpose. My purpose is to seek lost people like Zacchaeus. And when they come back out with a conversion statement, as I think Zacchaeus does, my purpose is achieved. John the Baptizer's purpose statement, he must increase, I must decrease. All those would be purposes. But I think that that's the outworking of the sense of call. That's Gordon's opinion. Don't check me against a theology professor. That was a great question to begin with. Thank you. Somebody else? Oh, come on, I wasn't that good. What else during the morning raises your interest in? Oh, is that a raised hand or are you scratching your ear?
Three things that have come out of that is what am I, where am I going, and what is my purpose? And they looked at me and said, this is your calling.
Okay, great. Thank you. Thank you. Way over there.
Could you elaborate a little bit more on your dailies?
On my days?
Dailies.
Oh. Well, the word dailies, I presume you're... Well, let me... you're asking about the dailies and how I might use them. I came along, I was raised in this tradition of devotional life that where everything is more or less spontaneous. We have spontaneous prayer. We used to say when I was a kid, we would never pray like the Catholics do with their written prayers. We like to, our phrase was, we like to pray from the heart. You've heard that phrase before? Well, praying from the heart's a very beautiful thing, but what I discovered over the years as I listened to a lot of prayers, most of all my own, was that praying from the heart can get very sloppy. It becomes very thin, very... it just doesn't go very far. And therein lies the power of the balance of studying the prayers of other great men and women of God down through the centuries, the prayers of the Bible, prayers of the great saints. And reading these prayers to see how other people brought their issues to God. So I became, over the years, a student, not a student, but a devotee of what I would call liturgical devotions. I frequently turn to the Book of Common Prayer, to what's called the Little Gidding Prayer Book from England. The Australian Prayer Book is very, very good. It has forms of worship and prayers. The prayers of John Bailey, who was a professor at the University of Edinburgh. And then you go into the prayers, the works of Brother Lawrence and Thomas A. Kempis and some of those. And you get a much broader perspective on things worth meditating on and praying for. Now, what the dailies represent are issues for me that I believe I want to keep alert to with regularity. If you listen to my story this morning and you look at these, you may see some similarities in the principles, don't you? And so you see where Gordon's going and what he's concerned about in the pursuit of his own spiritual journey. What these represent are things that I believe I should re-alert myself to every day, and the earlier the better. And so it sounds a little bit corny, but what I did was I printed these out. I don't think I can find, there's another part of this which I forget the number and I just can't turn it up right now. But this is all in a large plastic bag that hangs on the wall of my shower. So that when in the morning I'm showering, I can just allow my mind to course over these and ask, you know, is this fresh in my mind today? Do I really believe this? How is this going to work out in my daily exercise of life? I think it's a virtuous thing for everybody to do, is to find out what are those daily reminders that you believe will help you keep your spiritual journey on course. Where are the weaknesses? Where are the challenges that you believe you've got to readdress on a daily basis? So that's what it represents. There was more. Apparently some of you are writing this down. You can, by the way, find this in the book A Resilient Life. There's a whole chapter on it. Other questions? Don't want to prolong this, but like to tease out anything that you would like to go back to the morning and rediscuss. Ten more seconds. Anybody else?
Gordon, you mentioned earlier a change of call.
Yes.
Well,
I think this subject, could I tease out the subject of call a little bit in terms of the change of call? The whole theology of call is I think, somewhat inexact. Where do we get the theology of call from the Bible? Well, we course through from Genesis to Revelation, and we isolate those places where men or women were selected out by God and given some kind of... In fact, let me go into this for just a second. I'll have to go back a page here. Be patient with me. Let me give you a definition. A call comes from God, and when obeyed, means that a person is set apart for particular tasks of leadership and service, which will contribute to the mission of the church. A called person is held to greater accountability within the confines of that call and often sacrifices rights and privileges which are common to others. When I was a child, the whole notion of call was that pastors were called and missionaries were called and evangelists were called, but we were the select privileged few. We weren't paid much, but we were the select few. And and you used to hear parents say, "Our son has been called into the ministry." It was like the old proverbial Irish mother who wants her firstborn to be a priest. And so call had a very limited scope. Then around the 1960s, we had some American writers like Elton Trueblood who began to say, everybody's called. Well, what that did, I think, in my opinion, was it kind of washed out the nature of call, because if everybody's called, then in a sense nobody's called. You have to really rework the whole subject. And I've tried to come back in my own view of the biblical idea of call to something somewhere in the middle of the road, to say a call can happen to anybody, But it's a defined call. A person who's called really knows that they're called. And they and the significance is that they commit their lives to the duty and the obligation of that call. And they do. They give up rights and privileges. I don't feel like Gail and I have lived particularly sacrificial. I mean, we've had a good life in every way, shape, and form, and many privileges. But we both are aware that there are things which we have chosen not to do, or even things we've chosen not to own or have, or ways that we've chosen not to live, because we feel that there are certain rights that you surrender when you're called. And you have to live a little bit more of a circumspect life, and when you don't, believe me, I know this, you pay a high price. So that's important. Let me go on for just a minute here. A call involves obedience. That's where it really becomes effective. When a person hears the call, here's Isaiah, here am I, send me. Out of that comes your comment about purpose, a sense of mission. Mission and purpose would be the same meaning, I think. Out of that sense of mission often comes a vision on the part of the called person, because God begins to give them eyes of the heart to see what's possible. A called person often has a vision that no one else gets until the called person calls their attention to it. Paul had a vision for preaching the gospel where Christ's name had never been spoken before. So there's this vision. And often in alignment with call come certain competencies and gifts. I've separated those two words out. Competency, I'm not sure I like being this exact about it, but the natural talents that some of us have, gifts being what I would think are those extra special abilities that seem to come from the Holy Spirit alone. And then the call, finally, ought to have goals and objectives. How do we know when the call is being fulfilled? So if I were to develop a doctrine of call, it would follow that outline. Does that help? Does that give you any thought here?
Could you just see that you were mentioning a change? Do you find that a call is quite fluid in some occasions?
Well, I'm not speaking as an inspired one, as Paul says. But yeah, I do think that the call over a lifetime probably can take different directions. Although I must say, for example, my underlying call has been for 45 years to be a pastor. Now, you usually use that word pastor, you mean lead a church. No, I don't mean lead a church. That seems to be the most appropriate place for a pastor to function. But I would kind of like to claim that Gail and I take a pastoral view of everything we do in life. That it ascends to the highest priority in all of our relationships with people. We are always assuming that each day there's something pastoral about the way we're living. So whether or not I'm running a church or not running a church makes little difference to my sense of call. I'm a pastor. In my older years, I guess I'm a pastor in a fathering sense. You want to cut this and get on with something better? Okay. I'm sorry?
May I ask a question? Can a call be bruised? And if it was, what would be the practical steps to rejuvenate?
Wow, what an interesting question. Can a call be bruised or lost or withdrawn?
Yeah.
Well, I think we're left to speculation here. And the answer is, yeah, I think it can be deeply bruised. I think a person can forfeit a call by, beginning to live in defiance against God. Isn't Jonah doing something of that type? And yet God restores the call, doesn't he, in the Jonah experience? So, yes, the call can be bruised. It can be wounded, sometimes almost beyond repair. Can it be restored? Yeah. But I would suggest to you that depends upon the body of Christian people. See, it's no man or woman having sin can restore themselves. This is a transitive, or maybe it's a passive verb. I cannot restore Gordon. You must restore Gordon. And so, and this is one of the things that's alarmed me over the years. The church at large has a very poor understanding of the nature of restoration. Galatians 6:1. If a brother falls, you who are faithful should restore him, aware of the fact that you could fall too. And I'm sure most of you know that the Greek word there for restore is used three times in the New Testament. The first time it's used is when it describes the disciples repairing their nets. Why would the disciples repair their nets except that they want to use them again? Second time it's used is in Ephesians 4, where it's used now to equip the saints for the work of ministry. The third time it's used is in Galatians 6:1, where Paul says, if a brother has fallen, restore him. In all three cases, the force of the verb is toward future usefulness. So it must be in Galatians 6:1 that the intent Paul has is a brother has fallen for one reason or another. See if you can bring him back on the playing field. He's wounded. Restore him. Put him back into play again. So I've never, obviously you wouldn't be surprised that I would say this. I've never believed that a person 100% loses the call. If they are submissive, if they are deeply, sorrowfully repentant, whatever the failure of the sin has been, and if the church sees the genuineness of this, I think it's the obligation of the church to bring that person back into play. Not necessarily 100% what they were doing originally, but the intent of the restoring fellowship ought always to be, how can we bring this woman or this man back into service with the Lord? I would be willing to venture this opinion, that if the church could recover its ability to be a place of repentance and restoration, it would have all the revival spirit it wants. This is one. Satan cannot replicate or counterfeit forgiveness and restoration. Church, that's a unique stamp of the church. But the church today, for the most part, doesn't really want to deal with this. And so it's a very spotty thing. But those of you who are pastors, spiritual leaders, this is a place to think and study and really ask yourself, what could the church do more to bring people back to the gospel of the second chance? Because almost everybody in the Bible is a second chance person. There are a few players in the Bible that didn't get beaten to pieces in one way or the other, generally through their own shooting themselves in the foot or somebody else shot them in the foot. So that's a thought. Okay, I'm looking to see if anybody has anything to say, because next 45 minutes are mine. Your fault. Let's look at this wheel again. This wheel. We've gotten this far. So let me introduce a fourth point of exposure. This is a biggie. Somebody asked me just the other day, since I've been in New Zealand, I forget where I was. Oh, it was at dinner time, lunchtime on Sunday. We met a young man at the church service we attended, and he just happened to be from Texas. And so we took him out to lunch, and he asked a lot of wonderful questions. And one of them was, could you define character for me? And my immediate response, not that I haven't thought about this before, was the old adage is that character is what you are when no one is looking. Character is more than that. It's that deep, abiding intent of what we are. As God remakes us more and more in the fashion of his likeness, in the expression of being like Christ. I wish there was more of an emphasis these days upon character and what it means to grow in this area. But character is not something which I believe becomes static. As a kid, we were taught by the age of 21, your character is formed and it doesn't change from that point forward. What a devastating, depressing, defeating view. I don't think I would want to be here today if I believed that any longer. I'm 66, as I've said about 10 times today, because I know you just don't believe that. But I have great plans for the change of my character in the next 10 or 15 years. I hope that if I were to come back and stand before you in 10 years, you would have forgotten how bad this is, and then you'd do it to come a second time. But I would hope that 10 years from now, you would see a different man in front of you. Because I believe that character is something, while slowly growing, nevertheless grows. Let me talk about growth for just a minute as we approach this subject of character. Because I would like to challenge all of you to think of growth as one of the highest priorities in your daily journey as a public person. Let me give you 5 ideas about growth and see how they register with you. Here's the first. Growth is a subject that's easily, too easily, projected away from oneself and onto other people. What in the world do I mean by that? It's easier to preach about growing than it is to grow. And all too often, the pressure or the responsibility to grow is alleviated or diminished when we keep talking about it to other people. Now, we have to talk about it to other people, so let's be mindful of that, but let's not allow that to dissipate the sense of urgency that every day there must be an awareness on my part. How am I growing? I am so grateful to my mentors, the men and women that have been influences in my life over the years, because I have heard this continuously for years and years and years. You must keep on growing regardless of your age or station in life. There's an American novelist by the name of Scott Turow who's written a number of really good mysteries. And in one of them, I was reading along, and suddenly this sentence pulled me right out of my chair. The narrator in the book was describing a couple that he'd known for 50 years who were very politically active, and they were demonstrators on the streets of San Francisco, and you know they were doing all those activist things that the newspapers like to write about. And Turow, in his narration, says this. These are incredible words. Many years ago, I learned their dirtiest, most crab secret, that their passion to change the world derived from the fact that they could not change themselves. There's a lot of wisdom in that sentence. And I think about my own movement, the movement I've been born into and I've contributed to for the large part of my life. How often my people talk about changing the world. And I read that sentence and I found myself wondering, is a lot of our language about changing the world a subtle admission that it's easier to talk about changing the world because we're not satisfied that we ourselves are changing or growing? Listen to yourself if you become overcritical of, quote, the world. If you become more and more accenting how bad everybody else is and how wonderful, in contrast, we are. That could be a sure sign that somehow we are not satisfied with our own growth and development. So it's easier to compare ourselves with people who are apparently lagging behind us in one way or the other, or so we think we are. And as a preacher, I find this real danger in myself, that the best way to mask the fact that I'm not growing in the script that Christ has for me is to start telling everybody else they're not growing. So I got to get off this real quick. The second principle, this is a real obvious one. Growth is difficult. It's usually done in secret. It's humbling. And growth is rarely fun. Let me show you. I'll just sidetrack here. You may know this name. There was a man who climbed Mount Everest, since you guys are such great mountain climbers here in New Zealand. See Hillary's name all over the place. Jamie Clark, who climbed Mount Everest in 1997, wrote a book about it. Says about the training. When you get yourself in shape for a climb, you spend several hours a day working on an inclined treadmill with a heavy pack on your back. You look goofy, you smell, it's an ugly scene. That's always true. The road to success is not pretty. He could have been saying that about spiritual development and growth. Growth which is done in the Christian way is very difficult. And here's an important line, usually done in secret. Here's again a failing of our movement that I think we need to be cognizant of. We talk too much about the things we're doing to try to grow. God shows us a little insight. We feel like we're going to tell everybody about it. Every little thing has got to be analyzed, diced, and cut up. A lot of the ways God wants to speak into the heart, the things he wants to show us, at the beginning probably ought to be kept to ourselves. Like Mary kept all things and treasured them in her heart while the shepherds are running around talking about it. Well, you never hear about the shepherds again. I don't know why. Maybe they went to New Zealand and did all this sheep grazing. But the shepherds drop out, but Mary endures. Now, make the connection. I don't know whether there's any validity to it or not. But the shepherds have to go out and talk about everything real quick. Mary keeps things quiet, and she ponders them and allows them to stew in her soul. Growth is almost always humbling, and that's difficult for some of us who have a little bit of a pride problem. We don't like to deal with our defeats and our failures, so we end up spending a lot of time in denial or blaming. And when we get into that track, we don't grow. And it isn't always fun, and in our culture, we're told that nothing's worthwhile if it isn't fun. Idea three. Growth is a lifelong necessity for anyone in leadership. Let me deviate for a second with a story here. Gail and I go to Switzerland to walk in the Alpine valleys and in the upper elevations. And one day we were on such a trek, and we were in this valley, and there across the way from us were two Swiss peasant farmers, a man and a woman, and they were cutting the grass with these old, huge sickles or scythes, whatever you call them, as they were cutting the grass up and down the hill. And we sat and watched them for a little while, because the way they were doing it was in perfect rhythm with each other. It was almost like a ballet dance as they side by side going up the hill cutting the grass. And then we noticed after about 8 or 9 minutes that they stopped and each reached into his or her apron and pulled out a stone and began in the same rhythm to sharpen the blade. They did that for 2 or 3 minutes, put it back in, then they went ahead, more cutting. A few minutes later, the stone comes out, sharpens the blade. And what hit me as I watched that was the sharpening of the blade was part of the work. Now, they could have waited the whole day to sharpen their blades, but the longer they did that, the more they cut, the less efficient the cutting would have become, the harder the work would have been, so that by 3 o'clock in the afternoon, they'd have been exhausted by trying to run those dull blades through the thick grass. But every 8 or 10 minutes, sharpen the blade. That's something that somehow, when you think about it, makes a lot of sense in ministry. But it's so easily discarded because it doesn't have immediate results, and no one applauds it. And all you can hope is that by sharpening the saw, if you please, or the blade of the soul, that over the long haul, there's going to be results. Now go back to the scriptures once again and see the rhythms of our Lord. Mark chapter 1, verse 35. Early in the morning, while everyone was still asleep, Jesus arose, went out into a hillside, and communes with the Father. What's he doing? Sharpening the blade. Mount of Transfiguration, what's he doing? Sharpening the blade. So we need to understand this, that growth and all that goes along with it is a lifelong necessity. You don't sign off on growth at the age of 47. But it is an integral part to the schedule of anyone in leadership. Here are 2 or 3 caveats or fatal assumptions that come under that. There are some people who absentmindedly think, if I'm doing the work of ministry, I will grow. No, I would suggest to you that the work of ministry dulls the blade. That may be counterintuitive. But the more you preach, the more you teach, the more you administrate, the more you team build, the more you disciple people, the more you will lose out of your own soul. It's a drain. It's a discharge. So what you end up doing, my experience is, what you end up doing is you start repeating yourself. You keep going back to the same old stuff over and over and over again. A second fatal assumption: if I'm doing the work of ministry, my family will grow. That's even more mythical. Ministry costs your family. Ministry drains your marriage. So we can't afford just simply to say, I'm being faithful to God, therefore my family will be a blessed experience. That's the way an earlier generation used to think. I can remember, as a young man, the older missionaries and the older pastors saying to me, if you take care of the work of God, he will take care of your family. That's a satanic statement. Ministry will drain your family. It will dull your marriage, if that's the only way you look at it. And the third becomes even more serious. If I'm doing the work of ministry, I will be immune to catastrophic sin. No, you become even more vulnerable to it. So this is not really good, undepressing news. But these are alert statements that one discovers over the years as they watch others and as they experience some of them themselves and have to work to make sure this doesn't happen. Growth must never be discarded or ignored because of these myths. Principle 4. Growth is slowed if one only depends upon natural abilities. You may remember the story I told you in the first hour this morning about that Saturday morning when I woke up and discovered that I had an empty soul. Let me just take you back to it for a moment and make sure I know where I am here. This is what I was trying to say. If you look at that white line, it represents a fast start. The congregation is growing. The editors are accepting the things you write. Almost everybody likes you. But you're doing this on natural abilities and not on spiritual power underneath it. The kind of geothermal thing that heaven gives from underneath. Boy, wasn't that a neat illustration for New Zealand? I love that one. You can take that one for a long way. If you don't have that power coming up from the subterranean depths of spiritual power, and natural ability is all you're going on. Notice where the white line goes after about, what, the age of 38. It goes into a shallow decline. You know, there's very interesting research that shows that most people do their best work in life before the age of 40 or after the age of 40, but very few do it on both sides. My theory is that people who get their best work in life done before 40 probably have done it on the basis of genius and natural ability. Mozart writes great music till 36 and dies. And most of these great geniuses, they just burned out before they reached 38 or 39 years of age. Churchill, on the other hand, who was a very mediocre politician, does his best work in his 80s. If Churchill had died, you know, in 1935 he was in New York City and he came within an inch of getting hit by a car. If he had died that day in New York City, I don't think there'd be a person in this room who would have ever heard of him unless you were a serious academic historian, because he just didn't have that great a career before the age of 70. Then suddenly World War II comes along, and in 1940-41 he ascends to become the PM, and the next thing you know, we have one of the greatest men who ever lived in the 20th century. Go figure. So, if I live only on natural abilities alone, this shallow decline is likely what I'm going to find myself into by the time I hit 40. What I had to, let me go past that and just ask you to look at the red dotted line, because that was the big decision that Gail and I began to discover in our early 30s. That red, the red line represents people who didn't have the natural ability and who had to follow a life of growth and discipline that was intentional. Now notice where their line takes them. They don't start off as quickly, but they begin to build, and the power within them builds because God now has a hold of this person. And by the time they're reaching 50, they're soaring. And that's what you want. You want to look to your 50s and 60s and say, that's when I really will be soaring. And where God can use me in my most powerful possibilities to change lives and to influence institutions and do whatever it is that the call of God is upon my life. But that takes a very deliberate, intentional view of growth. Now let's go back here to see if I can get this. So if one depends on natural abilities, that perhaps will all be what we can expect. Let me give you one more point. Growth is usually quite gradual and difficult to measure on a moment-by-moment basis. Martin Buber, the Jewish philosopher, has a wonderful paragraph where he talks about watching a tree grow. And in effect, he says, don't waste your time. You're going to have to, in order to see a tree grow, you're going to have to come back about once a year. And then maybe you'll see a little bit of a difference. But if you try to watch a tree grow on a daily basis, you're going to be sorely disappointed. And so it is with the believer. Most growth happens almost imperceptibly. It just comes by millimeter, by millimeter, by millimeter. So those are principles of growth when you come to the subject of character and development that I wanted you to see. Let me show you for just a moment someone who doesn't understand growth. Here's Oscar Wilde, the English playwright back 100 years ago, who ended his life in abysmal disgrace. The gods had given me everything. That means natural gift. But I let myself be lured into long spells of senseless and sensual ease. Tired of being on the heights, I deliberately went to new depths in search of new sensations. And while the paradox was to me in the sphere of thought, perversity became to me in the sphere of passion. I grew careless of the lives of others. I took pleasure where it pleased me and passed on. I forgot that every little action of the common day makes or unmakes character. And that therefore what one has done in the secret chamber, one has someday to cry aloud from the housetop, which is exactly what happened to Wilde. His life ends up in ignominious disgrace. All of the sides of his sensual life become blared out across the London newspapers. And he dies in disgrace, if I remember right, in a Parisian cheap hotel. I ceased to be lord over myself. I was no longer the captain of my soul and didn't know it. I allowed pleasure to dominate me. I ended in horrible disgrace. That's a man who takes his character for granted. Let me show you one other person in English history, Samuel Taylor Coleridge, who wrote most of his poetry high on cannabis. William Barclay writes, there's Barclay again, Coleridge is the supreme tragedy of indiscipline. Never did so great a mind produce so little. He left Cambridge University to join the army. He left the army because he couldn't rub down a horse, returned to Oxford, left without a degree, began a paper called The Watchman, which lived for 10 editions and then died. It's been said of him, quote, that he always lost himself and envisioned a work to be done that always remained, however, to be done. Coleridge had every poetic gift except one, the gift of sustained and concentrated effort. In his head and in his mind, he had all kinds of books completed save for their writing. You get that old English writing? The books were there in his head, but they just never got to paper. I'm on the verge of sending to press 2 volumes, he said, but the books were never completed outside of his mind because he would not face the discipline of sitting down to write them out. No one ever reached eminence, Barclay writes, and no one having reached it maintained it without discipline. So what I'm trying to say, men and women, is that that's the character issue that we all have to deal with. Now, what is this whole issue of character development other than discipline? And in order to get very specific, I want to take you here. What you're seeing here are kind of my notes as I talk to you. My suggestion of 8 areas where the man or woman of God must continually grow in areas of discipline and character. This will take a few minutes to review, and I'm just giving you the whole list so you can write them down if you want. I want to suggest to you that one of the places where we address the issue of character first is in the care of our bodies, our physical disciplines. It's simply my opinion, but it seems to me that the care of my body and the discipline of my body is one of the ways that opens the door to the disciplines of the rest of the parts of my life. I worry for men and women in Christian ministry who ignore their bodies and do not realize if you don't keep your body strong and healthy, then the second half of life is likely to become relatively miserable. What good does it do to have a great message in your heart if you don't have a body to declare the message? And what effect do we have upon the people for whom we are responsible if they do not see us taking good care of what the Apostle Paul once called the temple of the Holy Spirit? We are a people who put a high premium upon keeping our bodies morally pure, and so it should be. What we have not done so well is to put an emphasis upon keeping our bodies physically strong or pure. So I offer you 3 thoughts. What is your schedule of rest like? What is your policy regarding nutrition like? And what can you say about your practice of physical exercise? There ought to be answers to all of those three questions. When men and women, and it happens all over the world, raise the subject of exhaustion, of fatigue, of burnout, has their state of mind and being, when you ask them to characterize their ministry, they're telling you that they're losing the battle in this area, or they don't have a good plan for how they fight this battle. Those of us who are men seem to struggle with this more than women. Gail and I had this wonderful few days at Taupo, and I said to Gail one morning after I came back from my early morning run, I said, you know, I was the only man out there working out. It's all women running, fast walking, getting the exercise. I don't know what that means, but it's typical of what I see in the United States also, that men don't, for the most part, take good care of their bodies until they have their first heart attack. Then suddenly some doctor gets through to them, they got to start walking or taking better care of themselves, what they eat, and how they rest and how they exercise. That ought not to be so for the man or woman who leads people. We ought to be leading the point and showing our people how to take good care of ourselves. The second area that the public person disciplines him or herself to grow in character is in the intellectual level. How do we keep growing in our minds? I was not encouraged in this area at all when I was young. Fortunately, God gave me a love for reading that began almost as fast as I could even see what a word meant on paper. So I've always loved books. But I can't honestly say that the people around me encouraged that. I was not encouraged to think. I was not encouraged to ask tough questions. I was rather encouraged to memorize easy answers. And that was Christian faith. Know all the answers and avoid the tough questions. We ought to be the masters of the questions. In fact, I would suggest to you that one of the greatest ways the Christian community can challenge the culture is to ask it questions it doesn't know how to answer. All too long, we reversed that and allowed the culture to ask Christians questions rather than for the Christian to be asking the culture questions that reveal the consequences of bad choices. You can only do that if you know how to think. You can only do that if you have a mind which is attuned to the reality of events and thought. And I'm not sure that we're producing in the modern Christian community enough deep thinkers who know how to deal in the currency of all the disciplines and the thought processes that are going on today. There used to be a day when the pastor was the smartest, most intelligent person in the community. And in those days, people went to the pastor for all the big judgments and the wisdom. It's been a long time since that's happened, at least 4 years now. But when we have the, you know, think about it. Think about it, those of you who preach. Your people give you one of the greatest gifts in a week that they give to anybody, and that's the gift of anywhere from 20 to 40 minutes of time where they will listen to you talk. How many people in a week do they give that privilege to? You get to talk at people, and they'll listen to you. You owe them substance. You owe them something that will connect with their minds, their emotions, with the depth of their hearts, that will send them on their way out the door changed, thinking new thoughts, provoked, maybe even sometimes a little bit angry, because you've upset their equilibrium and made them move in different directions. And that can only come not only from a person who is spiritually prepared, but a person who is intellectually sharp. Because they're in touch with sharp people all week long, and if the pastor doesn't meet that standard on Sunday, then people slowly, subtly write him or her off. So what are you doing to stimulate yourself intellectually? How much reading are you doing? How much in tune are you with the current events of the culture, the way the culture is moving? Is your language in touch with realities? Has Paul's language was in touch at Mars Hill? The intellectual disciplines are very, very important. The emotional disciplines are important. I have these feelings. How do I use them? Do people see me as an angry man? Do they fear that any time they say no to me, I'm going to sulk or pout? Do they see me as a person who becomes defensive whenever I take a word of criticism? Do they see me able to show joy and to truly laugh at appropriate things? How do they see me expressing my emotions? It's a very strong key to whether or not I'm a person worthy of being followed. The discipline of my relationships. We'll come back to this later this afternoon and even tomorrow. What's the quality of my ability to be a friend to people? How many friends do I really have? Or are my circle of relationships all people who look at me as number one while they're number twos and threes? How faithful am I as a friend? How willing am I allowing my friends to give to me and to serve me? What are my relational disciplines in terms of, am I taking time to engage with other people in healthy ways? Ego issue. If you're a public person and you have people around you who are following you, listening to you, then you and I must prepare ourselves that there's something inside of us not made of God that's going to want to swell and grow. It's called the ego. Great verse in 2 Chronicles 26. But as Uzziah became successful, he grew proud to his destruction. Uzziah forgot that he had an ego that was growing. So how do I keep my ego at right size? Probably I need a spouse who can help me to do that. I need a living relationship with God who will reduce me to true size at every Sabbath experience. How do I do that? My skill, my competency, those natural things I do well, am I developing them so that I do them well-er 10 years from now than I'm doing them today? It's a sad thing to see a man or a woman who never really continues to tune up and become better and better and better at the things that God enables them to do. But if you have a skill, then you and I have the responsibility for always growing that skill so that it is far superior at the age of 65 than it was when I was 27. Who is it? The cellist, Pablo Casals, now dead, plays 4 hours of scales on his cello 7 days a week from the age of 6 to the age of 96 and apparently never misses a day. Scales for 4 hours. Because scales, he says, are the basis for all music. One of the great basketball players in America years ago, Larry Bird, before every game shot 300 baskets before anybody came to the arena to keep his skill growing all the time. What do you do to sharpen it? If you're a great speaker, preacher, what are you doing to make sure that that ability is growing? If you're a writer, if you're an administrator, if you're whatever it is that God has called you and gifted you to be, what are you doing always so that every year that skill is getting sharpened better and better and better? And then finally, what we've already talked about, the spiritual disciplines. However and whatever it takes to bring you and me nearer to the Lord's presence. These are all the disciplines that build character. And when they're in place, a person then continues to grow. I'm sure some of you are very mindful of the great running exploits of John Landry, the Australian. There was a book by Neil Bascom about 2 years ago called The Perfect Mile, in which the story of John Landry and Roger Bannister, the Brit, and Wes Santee, the American, all competed to be the first to run the four-minute mile back in the early 1950s. And Bascom has this wonderful paragraph about these three runners. He says, all three runners endured thousands of hours of training to shape their bodies and minds. They ran more miles in a year than many of us will run in a lifetime. They spent a large part of their youth struggling for breath. They trained week after week to the point of collapse, all to shave off a second, maybe or two, during a race. The time it takes to snap one's fingers and register the sound. There were sleepless nights and training sessions in rain, sleet, snow, and scorching heat. There were times when they wanted to go out for a beer or a date, yet they knew they couldn't. They understood that life was somehow different for them, that idle happiness eluded them. If they weren't training or racing or gathering the will required for these efforts, they were trying not to think about raining and racing at all. I love that paragraph. It It reminds me that there is a price to be paid when you want to enter into the world of the extraordinary, when you want to change a few lives in the power of Christ, when you really want to build something that will long last after you are gone. Those things do not come to the undisciplined person who doesn't make the attempt to grow their character. Character is what it takes to build strong people. And discipline is what it takes to grow character. And I don't know any other better way to put it. So when I am a public person, I have to be mindful of these principles of growth and where it's taking me. Now let me take you back to the wheel again and suggest you a couple more components that will take us through the rest of the afternoon. Here's another one that takes some time and you can have a lot of fun with. The leader, the public person, faces exposure in the area of his or her core relationships. Surely most of you know the name Henry Nouwen, who was a Dutch Catholic priest who wrote some fabulous books back in the 70s, 80s, and 90s before he died. In one of his smaller books, but one of his more profound books, he says this. Take this quote very seriously, I encourage you. Most Christian leadership is exercised by people who do not know how to develop strong, healthy, I guess I added the word strong, develop healthy, intimate relationships, and have opted for power and control instead. Many Christian empire builders have been people unable to give and receive love. You know, he's really right. To the extent that I've had the privilege of meeting some of the better known people in the Christian world and watching their work up and close, I guess I think I've seen that quote come true over and over and over again. It's very, very difficult to lead an organization and at the same time have healthy relationships around you. The temptation is overwhelming to use and exploit people than it is to love them. To love people is often too messy, requires too much energy. It risks hurt and wounds, betrayal. And so it becomes easier to talk about love than to love. And it becomes easier to use and exploit people and then discard them when their efforts are no longer needed or appreciated. So it's very important for the public person, as he or she examines themselves and watches their progress, their life and their doctrine, very important to be asking tough questions about the core relationships in my life. One way to do it would be to, and try to look at the potential relationships a person in leadership has. Because you can probably, if you want to be real mechanistic about it, you can drop the names of the people you know into two categories. Those on the left, my public community, and those on the right who become part of my personal community. Now let me leave that on the screen for a moment and once again bunny track to a side. There's a wonderful book out that if you haven't seen it, you really ought to get into it one of these days. It's a quick read, very fascinating. It's by an American writer whose name is Malcolm Gladwell, G-L-A-D-W-E-L-L. He wrote a book about 4 years ago, maybe 5 years ago, called The Tipping Point. You can now get it in paperback. You've waited long enough. It's not a Christian book, but in it, Gladwell says some fascinating things that for those of you in leadership, you will find very, very interesting. In one of his chapters, Gladwell talks about the way we relate to the people around us, and he makes this interesting observation that the human being, for the most part, is only capable of sustaining about 15 to 18 at the most deeply intimate personal relationships. Beyond that, the human being is capable of sustaining about 175 general relationships. But probably not much more than that. Now let's explore that thought for a moment. Gladwell says the inner circle of 15 to 18 You can know who those people are with this definition. If any one of them died, it would have absolutely catastrophic implications for you for a reasonable future. So who are the 15 to 18 people in your life that if any one of them suddenly died, your life would be changed for a long, long time? You can know who the other 175 to 200 are by this definition. If you met any one of them at the shopping mall, you would have no problem in sitting down with them for a cup of coffee or whatever else and having a casual conversation. You know them well enough to do that. The rest of the people that you may know about are people that you need to keep in an address book, on a computer, in some list, and you can bring their names up when you need them, but they probably are not that significant to your way of life on a day-to-day basis. Now, here's some interesting things about that. Maybe now we know why Jesus only picked 12. Why Socrates only had about 15 disciples around him at any given time. Maybe we learn why real life-changing kinds of disciplers have understood for a long, long time that at any given time, you can only really deeply influence people in a life-transforming way at about a dozen at a time. When you go out to the 200 or the 175, maybe now we know why most churches never get beyond 150 people. Because most pastors can't lead people that they don't personally know. So when the church hits 150 or 175 at the most, it starts to level off. When you look at one of the large mega churches, you're probably looking at leadership that knows how to delegate and delegate and delegate and work things through other levels of people that many of us don't find it easy to do. But Gladwell's right. You can only have so many relationships. Down through the centuries, tribal villages have generally reached a population of 150 and then have either died or split apart. Battle groups are almost always of about 175. The most effective business units are about 150 because that's the most natural division of people congregating together. Very interesting study. Now, with that in mind, let's look at these relationships. Here's my public community. It's made up of people who carry these roles. In my public community, there will probably be someone or some group that serves a supervisory role for me. Those of you who are pastors, this may be your board. At least that's what we call them in the U.S. Whatever it is that you're accountable to, there are certain men, women in your life that you have to regularly account to, or you should have to regularly account to. And they determine whether or not your work is worthwhile or not. Then there are people who are your peers that you work with. Those of us on multi-staff church situations, we have other pastors, other pastoral assistants, but basically are teammates. And together we create a larger kind of work that's bigger than any one of us. But together we work in tandem, or should work in tandem, and the work gets accomplished. There should be in my public community a few disciples, a few Timothys, if you please, or Elishas, who are slowly growing, are teachable, are tucked up close to who I am and where I am and what I'm doing, and they are coming online so that someday, theoretically, they can be like teammates. Hopefully, every one of us in our lives have a few people that, biblically speaking, could be called lost people or seeking people into whose lives we're trying to pour the gospel of the love of Christ. There will probably be some strugglers, men and women who at this moment are weak and vulnerable and who cannot keep going without the support and encouragement and resources of people like myself. Here's an interesting group. This is the largest group. They're the spectators. They just come and attend. They throw a dollar or two into the offering plate. They sit in the back half of the sanctuary. They complain if the parking lot's too full. They like services at the most convenient time, and if the weather's nice, they may not show up. But we build big buildings for these people, and we feel real good when they're all crowding in for a day. But the chances are the majority of spectators are probably not going to go very, very far except to just enjoy the sunshine of what we're providing. I'm sure they don't have these in New Zealand. But in every public community, there's got to be a few critics. These are the people who get their attention by raising opposition and creating opinions and points that are more important than the larger interests of the organization. And we have to live with them. They are ubiquitous, and they are part of the social fabric. And then there's the bleeder. This is the person who gets attention by having problems. And you better not solve their problem, because they'll create another problem in the next week, because that's the only way they can keep you engaged. They like to talk to you at the end of every meeting, phone you several times a week, make regular appointments to see you. Their whole view of life is problem-centered. Now look at that list. That is the platform of your ministry if you're a people person. That's who you have to work with. Hopefully, every once in a while, out of the spectators and the strugglers and the lost seekers and even the critics will come a person who will cross the line and start moving upwards. Unfortunately, in most of our Christian leadership, we spend the majority of our time with this group because they're the people who make the most noise and they're the people who are most visible. Unfortunately, we should be spending our time for the majority of availability with this group of people. This is us. This is the Lord. If you look at the pattern of Jesus' ministry in the four Gospels, you'll see that he spent enormous amounts of time with his heavenly supervisor. I'm trying to be cute here, but Jesus did have a supervisor. The majority of his time with his teammates, who would they be? Peter, James, John? The disciples? And with the lost that came in his direction. That's Jesus' 80% of his time. And that's a very important understanding that we need to regain and refresh ourselves when it comes to asking, who's my public community? Now, in the last minutes I've got here, no, I don't think I'll do this. I think I'll pick it up from here, and because we want to have a quick coffee break and get ourselves awake again, and then maybe we can make the last hour redeemable. But I probably have moved too fast through that, but when I come back, I'm going to ask you what you think about it. So we'll see you in 15 minutes.